The following presentation, Janet Update, was given by Jeremy Sharp and Tim Kidd of Janet at Net Workshop 42 in April 2014.
So, an update of what we've been up to and a little bit of looking back as well. I think it would be good to just compare what we do now to what it looked like 30 years ago. So we're going to cover a bit of the infrastructure, as you'd expect, a bit of update on the services, 30 years of Janet, and then Jeremy will take us through some video, access and identity, and the infrastructure. So there we go. We currently have 749 gigabits per second of external capacity on the network. It's actually, I think, 748.5, but I thought that looked a bit bad. So 749 gigabits, that's what we've got. A couple of things I wanted to point out to you. Some of this stuff, as you know, is global transit. You can see we've got two suppliers coming off of London, Telesonera and GTT, and one, level three, coming off of Manchester. We pay for that by the megabit second, so that gets checked and we get charged by the amount we use that for. All the rest are private and public peerings, for which we don't get charged for the usage. And that's important because we're trying to expand the amount of private and public peering to reduce the amount we pay for, and I'll show you some graphs on that in a moment. So that's what we've currently got, 749 gigabits, and coming soon we're going up to 859. We've got a bit of stuff for the BBC for the Commonwealth Games. It's likely to be there just for the Commonwealth Games. Doubtless there'll be some stories next year about how all that's gone. And then we've got an extra 10 gigs on each of the links going into the links, so that's 40 gig capacity on each of those. We're going to have very soon 10 gig into Microsoft, 20 gig into Virgin. And this is the reason why we're attempting to balance those two things out. Here's the red, the underlying line that's going up, is the amount of traffic that we're sending on our global transit links. And we pay for that by the megabit month. The yellow line that's actually gone down is the amount we're actually paying per month. Not the unit cost, but the amount we're paying per month. So we've been playing the market, as many of you know, if you've come to Network Shop before. Every year we go out and we reprocure one of those sets of global transit providers and look for a better deal in the marketplace. So we're able to keep the cost just gently, slightly going down, but right down low, even though the usage, as you can see, is going up and up. Now, that's the perspective of just the global transit. To put that into perspective with the whole of the external traffic, now, in this slide, the top line is our total external traffic, and the bottom line is the global transit. So whilst the global transit has been going up, our total amount of traffic externally has been going up even more. And what we've tried to do is to increase the amount of peering that is useful to us so that we're reducing the amount, even though it's still increasing, that we're sending out through the global transit. And by doing that balance, we're reducing the cost of Janet, clearly. And we've hit 200 gigabits a second sustained peak now. Last year we talked about 100 gigabits sustained peak. This year we got to 200 gigabits quite often now. First sustained peak we saw on the 10th of March, iOS 7.1. We think that was all that was about. So that's quite good, quite exciting. So it's all working well. And then, of course, no talk at Network Shop about what we do in the infrastructure will be complete without telling about a few disasters. So this war story for this year is about Christmas. Christmas just gone. Some of you may remember Christmas just gone, and depending which part of the country you come from, some of you may remember it for all sorts of awful reasons. Remember the weather and the problems, particularly in the south of England. And that's where our particular story focuses. So here we are. Here's a bit of the south of England. And we have in Janet 6 a fibre run that starts at Bradley Stoke, goes to a lovely place called Froxfield, into Andover, and around to Southampton. Now, the going around to Southampton is quite important for the story, so remember that. That's quite important, that kink in the fibre there. So it was the 24th of December, at 20 minutes past midnight, when we lost connectivity on that link, one of the two links going into the south of England network. By 0207, the suppliers had told us, SSET, that there was a fibre break somewhere between Andover and Southampton. So we're focusing now on the kink. It's a good bit of animation, that, isn't it? Took me ages. At 0747, there was a helicopter survey, which apparently didn't quite do that route, apparently, so I'm told. But anyway, the helicopter was sent along to see if it could find the break. And the break was at Poulton Park. Now, I've misspelt Poulton Park. I'd like to say it's on purpose, but it wasn't. It's because it was misspelt in the tickets. And the reason that we know it's misspelt is, well, Jeremy told me, and I'll explain why as we go along. So, Poulton Park. Anybody heard of Poulton Park misspelt? Yeah, you see, it's people with children that know Poulton Park. You're quite right. Yeah, it's a place called Peppa Pig World. Quite right. And I was particularly impressed, bearing in mind why we were interested, in the logo on the Peppa Pig World website. It's a place for short breaks, which I was hoping was an omen, to be honest with you. That's what I was hoping for. So here we go. It's a pylon, folks. The problems with a pylon. Now, it's not just any pylon. This is a Type L6 suspension tower. Now, that's also important to know that. Any of you into suspension towers and pylons? Oh, you're going to love this bit then. Right. Now, on the top, there's no PGW. For those of you who aren't into this, it's an overhead power ground wire. It bonds the pylon to earth. So it's right at the top of the pylons, and it protects against lightning. Fair enough. So that's what they are, right at the top. And what they do with those OPGWs is they put optical fibres in them, thereby making OOPGWs, and it carries fibre. It looks a bit like that. So it has some optical fibre, multiple fibres inside the cable with aluminium-clad steel, which is used to protect it as an earth. That's what it looks like in reality, a bit like that, with those fibres in the middle. And that's where the fibre for Janet South was being carried, along the top of those pylons. So why do I know so much about pylons? It was a mistake, I have to admit. I asked John Seymour, some of you might know John Seymour, the head of network operations, because there'd been lots of chatter about the type of pylon this might be. There'd also been lots of chatter on the engineers' lists about what type of helicopter it was as well, but I've saved you. I've saved you from that one, believe me. And John is an expert because John is a member of the Pylon Appreciation Society. That's his membership certificate. It's true, he really is a member of the Pylon Appreciation Society, and it really does exist. So I'd been asking him about these pylons, and I made the mistake of tweeting him. His Twitter address is eWeed. And I said, I blame him for introducing me to the Pylon Appreciation Society, pylons.org, hashtag need help. And what happens when you do that, when you tweet that? What happens is you get this in response. Now try pylon of the month. So, I tried pylon of the month. And if you follow at pylon of the month and look, you get to this website. And it genuinely is a pylon of the month website where you can each month see a picture of a new pylon at which you can gaze in awe and wonder. So this is the real problem. These are very, very big towers. And that's a very big tree, and it's smashed itself into the cable. Now, bearing in mind what the weather was like and what was going on, you'll all know that there were lots of people who'd lost power. Tens of thousands of houses had lost power. There were people out in really bad weather trying to mend these electricity cables. So our fibre wasn't necessarily the top of the list. And that's a picture to get you a bit closer. You can see that as the fibre whizzes up to the top, it's slightly gone beyond its bend radius, just a tad. So that kink there was the problem. So back to the story. So there's this break at Poulton Park. We now know what Poulton Park is. So they start at 1:30 on the 24th of December, the removal of the tree, which is not an easy activity with the weather. And health and safety say stop. 5:30. Weather's getting worse, light's gone, you must stop, and you're not allowed to do it now till the 26th. So we enjoyed the 25th. And at midday on the 26th, a mobile platform had arrived in order to try and cut down bits of the tree that are on top of the pylon. At 12:30, we were told the ground's too soggy, and this mobile platform can't get where it needs to be to remove the tree. And all the equipment they need to drop the fibre, so as well as removing the tree, they've got to get to sort out the fibre itself on this very top of the pylon. All that's in use everywhere else, where people want electricity rather than just a piece of fibre. But by 15:40, they had removed the tree. So that's great. And they found two more fibre breaks on the way. So on the 27th, at 9:30, a special mobile platform arrived. This is a special mobile platform, they called a spider platform, that enables them to do work on that top fibre. But by 10:30, it was determined it had a mechanical fault, so it couldn't actually raise. By 12:23, a third platform was now on site. They're pulling out all the stops here. But unfortunately, it couldn't reach the fibre, which is a bit of a problem in the plan. 14:55, and a taller platform is now on the site. This is looking good. And they finished by just before 4:30, the first joint was complete. On the 30th, by 9:18, they'd finished the second mend, the second joint was complete. But the third break needs a temporary road built so that this spider platform can actually make it to where it needs to be. By 13:03, they had installed a temporary road. Now, that's not bad going, is it, really? But there's too much wind. And it's too dangerous to do the work. By 1800, the wind had dropped. And by 1942, the final joint was complete. And I just think it's worth pondering for a second this, because whilst we think about uptime and availability and resilience and all those things, and no one lost service through this because it was one of our resilient circuits, there were people genuinely up mobile platforms right at that top of that tower trying to mend fibres in wind and rain, in dangerous, truly dangerous conditions, just so we can Google or whatever else we wanted to do between Christmas and New Year. So it's worth thinking about that. So a couple of things on a few of our services, a quick update. We've been working with Janet ESIS, with ESIS, to produce a number of, to use a number of the penetration system, test testing systems, both an automated accredited one and a manual one, so you can choose bits you'd like to have tested, and some consultancy services. If you're interested in using that, then please do contact service at ja.net. And also there's a Birds of Feather session Wednesday at 4:15 with Lee Harrigan from Janet CCERT. So you can ask me any questions you like about anything, really, CCERT-y. By all means, do have a look at that. We've been doing a lot of work in the cloud area. Some of you will have seen the announcements. So some agreements with Microsoft Office, with Google Apps for Education, and recently with Archive and Tape Storage. And we're doing quite a bit of work on the transnational area, particularly got a pilot working with EduCity in Malaysia to help connect 2 to 3 universities who want to use a connectivity back into Janet and use it in their Malaysia campuses. That's looking very good. It's been interesting, but exciting work to get all that sorted out. There's a parallel session 4:15 with Josh and Jason who can give you all sorts of insights and update on what it's like to try and do that sort of thing. So do feel free to go and look at that. Which gets me to a bit about 30 years of Janet. So it's worth thinking a little bit about the evolution of Janet. So when Janet was born back in 1984, it was 9.6 kilobits per second to 50 sites on an X25 network. So how many of you were around using Janet then? So yeah, excellent. You might find some of the rest of this a bit interesting. But you got to, through that this period of its life, the dawn of Janet, as we're calling it here, up to a point in early 91 when we did an IP pilot and ran IP over X25. Oh, how the world has changed. Which gets us to us coming of age. And that got us into the Super Janets and landing in Janet 6 nowadays, where we went to 34 megabits and 155 megabits, a 10 gigabit core, 100 gigabit core, and now multiple 100 gigabit cores, where also we're running the optical layer. So quite a bit of change in the time that Janet's been around, I think. I thought it'd be worth just looking back at some of the information we've got from when Janet was much younger. So here's some old pieces of paper that Shirley found in the archive that we've scanned in. So here's 1986, Ian Smith, some of you might remember Ian Smith, with the statistics for the switches. And it's the mean time between failure that I'd just like to draw your attention to. You know, in these days, this was absolutely fine. 93 hours mean time between failure was absolutely okay. Think about if you offered a service now with that, or even, for that matter, 744 hours mean time between failure. Cambridge was winning there. That was the best one, 744 hours. Just imagine what people would say. Here's some statistics of the packet switching exchanges from 1987. And there are numbers on them and arrows. The numbers in each of the exchanges, and there's numbers shown on each of the circuits, so they're traffic volumes. So 16, 1, 33, 78, 245. The unit of measure for traffic in 1987, megabytes a day. So that's the way we were measuring traffic at that point, megabytes a day. Just imagine that now. If you say, it's okay, we'll allow you 78 megabytes today in total for your university. Here's a addressing scheme. Now, addressing schemes haven't changed much, have they? They're always a pain. They're always a nuisance. And just when you've done one thing, someone wants to change it. Here's some changes that were being made back in 86. You can see the old numbering scheme on the left-hand side, the new one, and some crossings out as things have been changed. And what interested me about this was not so much that we were changing the addressing scheme, because, I mean, that happens from time to time, but the handwritten note on the bottom that you can't see because I've chopped it off, and it said this. Tell Cambridge they can't have 220XXXX anymore. Instead, they can have 219 if they want it. So it's always a bit like this, isn't it? Things always change around you just when you think things are sorted out. I have no idea if Cambridge used 219 or not, but there you go. So to help us celebrate 30 years of Janet, we'd like you to do a few things. We'd like to join us for a bit of birthday cake straight after this plenary session. So do that in the exhibition hall. I'm just looking, hoping people are saying yes. Exhibition hall, yes, right. In the exhibition hall for a bit of birthday cake. Please do that. And it's not just a ploy to get you there to talk to the exhibitors. It clearly wouldn't be that. It's just to give you a piece of birthday cake, honest. If you want to look back to the past on the web, there's a dedicated area to celebrate 30 years of Janet. Information's in your pack, so you can see that and have a look back at some old photographs. Some old photographs of some people who are still around in Janet today, many of whom apparently have offered to throttle the people who gave them the photographs. So please do look. Should be interesting. For the future bit of this, do look at community.jo.net. Join up, join the conversations there. From looking back at the past of the web, come and join us with the present and the future. There's lots of interesting webs of people talking about things that are interesting. So join in the conversation at community.jo.net, please. And don't forget as well, if we're being modern for a bit, to tweet with the hashtag NWS42 and follow us on UK Net Workshop. And there's a competition. Oh yes, competition at www.ja.net/NWS42, for which you can win a free place at NetYear's Net Workshop. What more could you want? Where are we next year? Exeter. So join us in Exeter with a free place at Net Workshop. Just take part in the competition at j.net/NWS42. And if that's not enough excitement with the 30-year celebration, then this will blow your socks off. In your packs, you've got some ticket which requires you to go and meet the Janet, see the people at the Janet stand in the exhibition hall. Not that we're making you go to the exhibition hall, but if you go to the exhibition hall and go to the Janet stand with your ticket, you can get a free 30th birthday mug. I can just feel just the tension in the room. Just imagine that. So a free Net Workshop, Janet's 30th birthday mug, so please do that. So, that gets us to the end of 30 years of Janet, and it's time to look a little bit at some of the future work that we're doing. I'm going to hand over now to Jeremy.
Thank you, Tim. Okay. Tim's given us an insight into a lot of things that have been happening in Janet over the past year, and there has been an awful lot. I've had trouble really deciding what to focus on in my bit of the talk, and I've decided to sort of pick on three key areas where there is quite a bit of change happening. The first of those is on video collaboration. Now, this is fairly close to my heart, as when I started in Janet back in the sort of mid-90s, I started off in this area of launching the first Janet video conferencing service. And I think that was back in 1994. And over that time, the service has seen very good use and steady growth over the years. But the nature of video collaboration has changed quite radically from what it was in the mid-90s. So in response to that, and after a lot of consultation and watching how the service has been used in the past, we will be launching a reinvention of the Janet video conferencing service in the summer of this year called vSeen. So you've heard it here first, or for readers of Net Workshop, we've got a taster article of what's to come. And vScene is about supporting video collaboration. It will still help you organise and schedule your video conferences, should you need to schedule them. It also recognises that there's quite a lot of systems that do video conferencing, both proprietary and standards-based. And what we are aiming to do is try and allow you on the client that you use to be able to talk to other people using whatever client they use. So it'll provide a certain level of interoperability. We, of course, aim to make it intuitive to use and use on any device that you choose. And a feature as well that we'll be introducing is automated testing to ensure quality of your sort of video experience. My colleague Tim Boundy will be talking a little more about what's in store in one of the parallel sessions in the coming days. We're also supporting video in a much broader sense, and you heard reference, I think, to what we've done with the BBC and the Olympics on the real high end of video. And I guess a lot of you might have seen a demonstration of musical performance over the network, which has been enabled by some technology that really minimises the latency of transmission over the network to a small number of milliseconds. And this picture here is a performance taking place in London at the Janet 6 launch back in November last year, and linking up to Edinburgh Napier University. And the lady performing on the screen there has actually got a saw in her hand, and it was quite a fascinating performance she gave there. This is a picture of me and a colleague in the team at Cardiff University, and we were actually watching in 3D HD a virtualization of their radiography suite that they use to train students. So rather than tying up an actual radiography suite, they virtualized the environment, this was us watching the demonstration of that. This is a picture of student TV, the sort of NASTA student TV. We provide them with a streaming service that they are able to stream their events out over Janeton. And our aim over the coming year is to make that service much more broadly available, so offering a Janet streaming service. And finally, there's been an awful lot of interest to contribute into broadcast networks, so getting experts in universities, either contributing to sort of news programs or whatever it may be. And that's always been possible, but generally through dedicated links into broadcast networks or you know, the BBC turning up on site with one of their outside broadcast units. What we're aiming to do here and what we have done is we've got a relationship with a broadcast contribution network, link that into Janet. So over Janet, from your university, if you have a studio, you're able to link into that service and into that contribution service. This is actually a post-production edit, so I have to sort of come clean here, this picture. And it was agreed between the BBC and the University of York, just showing typically what can be done. I do have other pictures that are sort of real contributions, but I thought that was a neat picture to show you there. So a significant amount really supporting the area of video collaboration, and a lot of exciting things to come over the coming year there. The next area I thought I'd sort of pick on is a really important area of access and identity management. And we've done a lot of work over the past year in pulling together a single access and identity management across JISC. and pulling together the activities, the service delivery, the development around these four key services, which will be hopefully very familiar to you. The first, obviously, being Access Management Federation, so access to web-based resources, the very familiar EduRoam, of course, service certificates, and our new development, Moonshot, which is about access to non-web-based resources. So we've pulled together a strategy, recognising that these are all about in some form or other access and identity management, or supporting access and identity management. They all have sort of common operational approaches, a fairly common sort of user experience, and common sets of policies that wrapped around them. So recognising that, we brought together a strategy that will help us deliver the service more efficiently, but more importantly, help to enhance the user experience around this, whether you're an end user or whether you're involved in deploying these types of services. And the aim is really to put the UK in very much a leading position around the delivery and use of these types of services to manage access to online information and other resources. So just to give a little bit of an insight really into what we're actually doing, the plan associated with that strategy. So around EduRoam, I think three key areas. One key area, our aim is to increase the coverage and footprint of EduRoam. Excellent coverage in the university sector, not so fantastic in the FE sector. But where we'd really like to crack coverage is to make it more pervasively available, whether that's on public transport, public spaces. And there's been a number of really good initiatives around some city wireless projects, and what's happened in Portsmouth, I think, is a good example of what can be done to make city-wide wireless available. And EduRoam being part of that. So that's one key area that we'll be tackling. I think the other key area is the user experience. I don't know about you, but when I go to various places that support EduRoam, it can be a bit hit and miss whether it actually works or not. So we'll be tackling that area. And I think the other area which should help smaller organisations deploy EduRoam is to improve the manageability of EduRoam. And what we'd like to look at there is the holy grail of actually providing a managed service, either a managed IDP service or a managed appliance service. So those are two key areas that we're looking at in that space. In terms of service certificates, the top right there, we're actually procuring how we will provide these certificates. So re-procuring the certificate authority, that's currently in procurement now, and those new certificates will be available later this year, and that will result in a richer variety of certificates being available to you. In terms of the Access Management Federation, we've been playing a very active role in the software that supports the Access Management Federation, Shibboleth. We're a founder member of the Shibboleth Consortium that actually maintains and develops the software. So we have a very big say in how that software develops. We work with Internet2 and with Switch in Switzerland as the other consortium members. Version 3 of Shibboleth will be available later this year. And again, what we're sort of looking at here is how we can provide more support in managing providing managed services around the Federation. And finally, I think our sort of flagship development here in this space is Moonshot, where this really has been a vision of one of my colleagues that we've taken from vision through the standards bodies, the IETF. It's been quite a slog over the past 2 years, but we've got there, through to engaging some very, very bright, very specialist developers. And we're running a pilot now with just over 40 to 50 organisations piloting Moonshot, both in the UK and also in the Géant context across Europe as well. And that will take us towards service launch in the first half of 2015 there. And we've also been working in that context with Microsoft, who very pleasingly have been very keen on Moonshot. They see a lot of potential in what it can do. And they've worked with us to provide a proof of concept into their Azure service and platform. Okay. So the final area I'd like to look at really, and I didn't want to sort of get away without really mentioning Janet 6, so this is a bit of a link into Janet 6. With Janet 6 sort of built, deployed and sort of running extremely well, we're busy extending that backbone capability at the moment in many ways, but this is just one example really in the research context. I probably sort of mentioned this at last year's NET workshop, but working with the research councils, we identified a number of key UK-based public research facilities that really need that high bandwidth connectivity. And so with that identification and the government providing us a little bit of money to provide that connectivity, we're in the final stages now of connecting the Hinxton campus near Cambridge, which is a key sort of bio research campus, the Met Office, the Norwich Research Park, which is the non-genome research campus, and the new Francis Crick Institute in London. And again, that's been about procuring fibre, working with our partner there, SSET. You know, they've not been without their challenges, given what Tim was saying, the weather over the winter and the flooding. But we're now in the final stages of bringing the East of England bit of that, the Hinxton and Norwich Research Park, into life, and that'll soon be followed by the South of England in a few months. I'd like to mention an initiative in the e-infrastructure context to support universities and other research organisations that work with industry. And as you'll appreciate, the government is driving very hard the agenda of universities working with industry more and more. And we obviously want to play our part in making sure you can do that. So just, I think, early in the new year, we launched an initiative called Janet Reach that aims to support industry connectivity to Janet, where that industry player has a research collaboration with a university, with a research institute, or wants to get access to facilities that university provides. So it's access to knowledge and experience, access to resources, and really when those two become required at scale, that's where you need Janet connectivity. If they're at low scale, you can go through the normal internet and get that sort of access. But where that's needed at 1 gig and above, then this is where Janet sort of reach really comes into its own. And the challenges around this are not technical at all. Connectivity is connectivity, and that's what we do. It's really keeping on the right side of the state aid regulations. So we've been working and watching very closely how the Technology Strategy Board work. We're using a lot of their processes and procedures to make sure that we are compliant with state aid. And I think later on in the programme on Thursday morning, there's a really interesting talk from Rolls-Royce there and how they're working with some universities and will hopefully be making use of this scheme to connect to Janet. And finally, again, another really important, I think, sort of quite groundbreaking activity with a number of key research-based organisations that have come together, mainly around London, to procure a shared data centre. This is driven by mostly strategies, and I think a lot of you will recognise this as well, of rationalising their comms rooms and data centre estates, outsourcing a lot of services and increasingly looking off-site because of valuable real estate that can be used in a more cost-effective way for teaching and learning. And what's, I guess, sort of special here is the nature of these organisations. They're very heavy research-based organisations and research collaboration, and they've come together with us to jointly procure a shared data centre. So we launched that just over a month ago, and we're moving towards the final stages of procurement for a large data centre that's not more than 4 hours travelling time away from any of the organisations there. As I put on the slide there, about 60% of the use of that data centre will be for putting in HPC storage systems that support research, and about 40% indications are that it'll be used for hosting enterprise systems. We're working to very, very challenging timescales, so that's got to be up and running by the 1st of July. We'll be connecting that directly to the Janet backbone, and that framework will be available for the wider university sector to make use of as well. And if this is successful, we envisage replicating that model as much as we need to. That's my time up. I just want to leave you with these sort of very simple words here. But last year, big focus on Janet 6. We all did it, working with you. I think we've got a fantastic resource that we're building on, which I've just shown you, giving you a hint of what we're doing there. And both between Tim and I, we've shown you how I think there's lots of great stuff to come as well in the coming year. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much to Tim and Jeremy. We have got time for questions. And hopefully there should be some students around with some, yes, there are, with some microphones. If you can put your hand up if you want to ask a question. Question from me. You mentioned the data centre, and you said it was going to be available for universities. Are you making it wider to the FE colleges and the research organisations as well?
Yep. The nature of the data centre that we're procuring on behalf of the organisation, as I've showed, is very much geared around research requirements. What we would hope to do is use a lot of the experience that we've learned through this procurement, if there is a requirement in for the smaller organisations, perhaps for more disaster recovery enterprise-based requirements, then we could go out to the market on behalf of that customer base and procure an appropriate facility.
Okay, thanks very much. Any further questions? Yes. John. We need a microphone. Somebody's going to have to be very fit. Especially going to the gym today. And if you can say your name and institution, John, that'd be great.
Is that working? Yeah. It's John Mason, University of York. You were discussing the data centres. Where are they going to be located, or is that still to be part of the procurement, the shared data centres?
Yeah, it's one data centre that we're procuring, and we're at the stage now, the final stages of the procurement process, so we don't know yet.
You don't know yet. No. So I was just wondering, because the ethos nowadays is to sort of house them in sort of the wilds of Scotland or something for the energy efficiency for the free air cooling, give or take a vote or two.
But that won't be 4 hours from London.
No,
it's got to be. So it's got to be 4 hours from London. Yeah. So it's because the energy efficiency is going to be one of the key things, particularly with the.
That's right, and we've put in some very strict requirements around PUE, and around also minimising the electricity costs as well, in various different ways. So we'll be able to talk a lot more freely about what we've done once we've popped out of procurement.
And there's another question up there, and then I'll come down to
the side. Hi, Sean Duffy from University of Birmingham. For the on the shared data centre, is it colo or is it shared tin? And secondly, what about carbon charges?
It's colo. It's as simple as that, so flexible colo space. The carbon charges, so the way we're setting up the procurement, it is a framework, which Janet will hold the framework contract, but each of the organisations will be contracting directly with the supplier. So that'll be, I guess, the organisation's responsibility, working with the supplier there.
And another one over here.
Bob Franklin, University of Cambridge. When the Olympics was on, there was a lovely set of HD multicast streams, 24 of them, with all of the different events on. I notice now that all the multicast streams of broadcast television have disappeared for some reason. I'm not quite sure why, whether that's a Janet thing or not. But I just wonder, is anything special being done for the Commonwealth Games, multicast, HD, whatever? Is it just going to be iPlayer?
I might... do you want to pass the microphone along to your right? My colleague will answer.
Yes, I wasn't actually aware until a couple of weeks ago that the BBC had switched off the multicast streams that for the live TV sections. I shall talk to them. It's not something that we've done. It's something that's been done at the source, but we'll try and talk to them about it.
Okay.
And we are, at the moment, in active discussions with the BBC, looking at how we can support the Commonwealth Games sort of video transmission.
Any final questions? Okay, well, thank you very much, Jeremy and Tim. Our next speaker is Alan Gaddian, who's a senior scientist at the UK National Centre for Atmospheric Sciences, and he's currently based at the University of Leeds, and he's going to talk on computational and network challenges for large-scale, high-resolution weather modelling in the WISER project. So this fits in quite nicely with Tim's comments about the weather problems we had earlier and how they impacted Janet. So over to you, Alan.
This recording was brought to you by Janet Training as part of NetWorkshop Online. Further information is available on our website at www.ja.net/training.